The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
What is the work of a vice president? Casting a tie-breaking vote in the Senate? No longer. In Angler, the Cheney vice presidency, reporter Barton Gilman reveals the vice president, or Angler, his Secret Service code name, as a man of deep conviction and remorseless will, who reshaped his office and his times. After two terms as a loyal and valued advisor, how has Cheney redefined the job, and what is his legacy? Based on original reporting and hundreds of interviews with Cheney's allies and his rival, Gilman takes on the full scope of Dick Cheney's work and its consequences, from unleashing the NSA to spy at home to promoting cruel and inhuman methods of interrogation. Barton Gilman is a special projects reporter at the Washington Post, following tours that cover diplomacy, the Middle East, the Pentagon, and the D.C. Superior Court. His Cheney series for the Post won him a 2008 Pulitzer, a George Polk Award, and the Goldsmith Prize for Investigative Reporting. He also shared a Pulitzer for National Reporting in 2002 and has won many other prizes. He's the author of Contending with Kennan, Towards a Philosophy of American Power. In conversation with Mr. Gilman tonight is Nick Goldberg, who has been the editor of the op-ed page of the Los Angeles Times since 2003. And since 2007, he's also edited the paper's Sunday opinion section. The range of people Nick knows is remarkable, and the range of subjects he covers is also amazing. He's a former Middle East bureau chief for Newsday. And in that position, he covered many major stories, including the peace process in Israel. Barton and Nick were just talking about how Nick always used to have dirt on his shoes after he'd be tromping around Gaza, the West Bank and Gaza, presidential elections in Iran, arms monitoring in Iraq, famine in Sudan, and civil war in Algeria. From 1992 to 95, he was the paper's State House bureau chief, covering the administrations of Governors Mario Cuomo and George Pataki, and he also covered Bill Clinton's first presidential campaign. Please enjoy this evening. When you do ask questions, we hope that you'll ask a question with a question mark at the end. That would be very helpful. Books will be sold afterwards in the lobby, courtesy of our library store, and Mr. Gilman will be signing afterwards. Please welcome Barton Gilman and Nicholas Goldberg. Thank you.
Hello? Hello? Can you hear me? I'm Nick. That's Bart. I wanted to open up with a story which I'm sure that Bart is sick of hearing, because he's heard it from me several times, and I'm sure he's heard it from other people. We first met in 1995 when I arrived in Jerusalem in October to be the Middle East correspondent for Newsday, the New York newspaper. Bart was already there for the Washington Post. I got there in October. In early November, Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin was shot and killed. I had just gotten there 2 weeks before. I had no idea what I was doing. There was a tremendous amount of news, but for foreign news reporters, it was hard to imagine where you could get information. At a crisis time like that, everything shuts down. You can't just call up the police and ask what's happening. You can't call the prime minister's office. You have no idea. It happened late at night. We all rushed out that night. We went to the hospital. We drove from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv and went to the hospital where it happened, but there was very little information forthcoming. So we kind of relied on what we heard on Israeli radio, Israeli TV. We couldn't get that much information. I wrote the same story, basically, that everyone else wrote. If you opened all the American newspapers the next day, you saw very similar stories, except if you looked at the Washington Post. And if you looked at the Washington Post, you would see that Bart had written a story in which he interviewed the murderer. And this is it's kind of stunning that something like this should happen. And you may wonder how it happened. Well, let me explain to you that that Bart had gone out, he had trudged out to the West Bank on some story 5 months earlier. And in the course of interviewing probably 20 people that day of the 50 people he interviewed every day from then in June until November, one of the people he interviewed was Yigal Amir, who went on to kill the prime minister. And when I looked at this story, I mean, when we all looked at this story, all us jealous and bitter people in the foreign press corps looked at it the next morning, I mean, some people said, that's just luck. He was in the right place at the right time. But what I learned about Bart over the years is that it was not luck, and it's never luck, and that he may be in the right place at the right time, but he's in the right place at the right time for the right reasons, and that he doesn't forget a thing, and he didn't forget that he met this guy, and he didn't throw out his notebooks, and he went back and he found his notebooks. I mean, I could never find a notebook from more than 2 days earlier. After that, they get flung in the corner, or I throw them out, or I write, you know, what I need to get at the store. And Bart never does that. And he's, Bart, you're very privileged to be here with Bart today, because he's an extraordinary reporter. And the book that he's written is filled with extraordinary reporting. You're going to see from some of these stories, you're going to see the level of detail he has, and it's what makes the book really great to read. It's what makes him a great reporter, and I hope I can just draw it out of him tonight. Just before I finish, I also want to say that for those who thought it was just luck that he was in the right place at the right time, a few years later, I saw Bart in New York. He had been moved back by the Washington Post, and he was covering New York now at the time when it was found out that Mayor Giuliani was having an extramarital affair. And it just so turned out that the object of the mayor's love happened to live in Bart's building. So you can call it luck, but I think he knew the whole time.
It was supposed to be an undisclosed location.
So, all right, I have so many questions. I didn't even know how to begin to cut them down. But to start with the big picture, if you read your book, you get the sense that that Dick Cheney, the vice president, is single-handedly, or he and his particular close group of cronies are single-handedly responsible for virtually every major controversial policy that came out in this. Through the course of this administration. You attribute to him the pursuit of what you call robust, or what he calls robust interrogation, by which I think we mean torture, stripping terror suspects of their rights, the idea of the unitary executive, that the president should be unstoppable and unlimited by Congress in any way, or virtually any way. Cheney and his aides were behind the rollback of various environmental protections, the creation of Guantanamo. They pushed for the war, and Cheney and his close coterie of aides were particularly responsible for pushing the fear of the weapons of mass destruction that we all turned out not to exist. Is that really true? I mean, to what extent is Cheney the author of the Bush legacy? What has he done to the vice presidency to allow him?
Look, he's an author of big chunk of it, but the story's never simple, and it changes over time. There's sort of a trajectory to this vice presidency in which he has what you might call a very powerful, productive period in the first term, and there's a particular episode in the book, I'm sure we'll talk about this, sort of meltdown of the Justice Department comes in March of 2004, and that's sort of a pivot point in which he loses some of the president's confidence, and in the second term, instead of sort of driving the car forward, he's the guy applying the brakes to make sure that his accomplishments aren't rolled back, but he's not able to drive policy so much anymore.
Tell us, before we get into some of the details of the stories that you report on, tell us a little bit about who these guys are. Tell us a little bit about Dick Cheney's background and a little bit about these two guys who were his chief aides.
Well, everybody knows Cheney's background. You know, he's a sort of laconic Westerner who comes to Washington on a fellowship and meets Don Rumsfeld and becomes sort of his assistant at the Office of Economic Opportunity under Richard Nixon. And Rumsfeld brings him back when Rumsfeld becomes chief of staff to Jerry Ford, and then Rumsfeld goes off to run Defense Department, and Cheney, at the age of 34, becomes chief of staff at the White House, the youngest ever. He's really good at it. He is an exceptional manager. He probes deeply, he thinks hard, he keeps a lot of balls in the air very well. And at that time, he believed very strongly in an orderly process. Now, you know, if you're chief of staff, you're going to be in favor of an orderly process. He said often after that that you have to protect the president from, oh, by the way, decisions. So, you know, you have a group of people talking to the president, and it's about subject X, and on the way out the door, one of them sort of slips in subject Y and says, should we do that? And the president says, sure. You don't want that. You want orderly vetting. You want everyone's voice to be heard. And when Jim Baker was about to become Ronald Reagan's chief of staff, he sat down and interviewed Cheney, and I got hold of Baker's notes, and the notes have in all capital letters what Cheney said: be an honest broker. Don't use the process to impose your views on the president. As vice president, he did not honor that advice. He was no longer the process guy. He was an independent constitutional officer. I mean, one of the things you don't often stop and think about is that he's actually not fireable. The president can't fire the vice president. And he believed that his job at this point was to drive policy and not to sort of coordinate.
It brings up two questions I have about his predecessor, Dan Quayle. First of all, you tell a story in the book about Dan Quayle coming to talk to Cheney right after Cheney became vice president. I think that's an interesting conversation that you should describe. But you also talk about another incident with Cheney that occurred back when Cheney was vice president, and I think when Quayle was vice president, and I think Cheney was Secretary of Defense, which shows just how much Cheney changed from one role to the other. So why don't you tell those two stories?
Yeah, Dan Quayle recounted a fascinating little interchange with Cheney. He went to visit, it was kind of a courtesy call, right after inauguration in 2001. And he went to the West Wing, visit Cheney's office, and says, one vice president to another, let me just tell you how it's going to be. Here's what it's like being vice president. You know, you're going to do a lot of flying, you're going to go to a lot of funerals, you're going to do a lot of sort of ceremonial occasions that the president doesn't feel like doing. You'll do fundraisers. That's what we all do. And Cheney just looks at him and says, almost expressionless, I have a different understanding with the president, which gives me the name of chapter 2 of the book. And Quayle tries to draw him out. And, you know, like, Cheney is not a big talker. He makes very effective use of silence. He stops most conversations when the other person's not really ready. You know, so he'll say one thing and he'll stop. And, it was my turn to talk, you know. And Quayle tried to draw him out. And what Quayle said he concluded at the end of this conversation was that Cheney wanted to be a sort of super chief of staff or maybe deputy president. Quayle used both of those terms. And I think Cheney is the nearest thing to a deputy president we've ever had. It was surprising to Quayle because of the other thing you allude to, which is that back when Quayle was vice president, Cheney was defense secretary, Bush, Scowcroft, Baker, and others were on their way to a summit meeting with what was then the Soviet leader. And the Philippines had a little mini crisis. There was a coup attempt. And so Dan Quayle says, well, you know, I guess I'm in charge. They're all off the airplane. And so he tries to convene a National Security Council meeting. And Cheney refuses to go because, and he's right, there is no such thing as a National Security Council meeting unless the president is there. If they meet without the president, maybe, you know, a principals committee meeting, but it doesn't have that kind of legal authority. And so he just said to Quayle, you know, you don't have authority to make any decisions. And they're raising options and around the table in the sit room. Quayle and the others are coming up with the idea that there should be, you know, aircraft sent aloft over Manila to because the coup plotters have taken over the Air Force and are threatening to bomb the presidential palace. So the idea is U.S. aircraft should go fly sort of defensive mission. And Cheney says, I'm going to have to hear that order from the president. You know, you're not in the chain of command. The chain of command, by law, is the president to the Secretary of Defense, who transmits the order through the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to the combatant commander. That's all true. This became especially interesting on September 11th with the order to shoot down aircraft that were believed to be hijacked.
Well, in the book, when you talk about September 11th, you lay out this very well-described minute-by-minute account of what happened to try to get at the heart of who ultimately gave that order, that planes could be shot down if they had been hijacked. I'm not sure you really reach a final conclusion. Tell us a little bit about what happened that day.
Well, let's just start with what's already known. The 9/11 Commission laid out in some detail what the sequence of events was. There was a belief that there were still planes in the air heading toward Washington, that they were hijacked. Turns out they were actually, the FAA had lost sight of United 93. Because as we now know, it had crashed in Pennsylvania. And so they projected its course forward. And so they're saying, it's 80 miles out, it's 60 miles out, it's 20 miles out, and it's heading for Washington. And they're not answering our calls.
Now, the president, meanwhile, is reading My Pet Goat.
The president is now in the air, in Air Force One. And, all the money we spend on communications links, turns out they can't reach him very well. So the question gets asked, what are we going to do about this plane? And a military aide comes up to Cheney and says, well, do we have authority to shoot it down? There's, by now, Air Force jets have scrambled. And Cheney says, yes. Now, Cheney and Bush both testified to the 9/11 Commission that Bush had given Cheney that permission in advance, and Cheney just conveyed it. I go through, and the 9/11 Commission, it was very careful in parsing that. Its final conclusion was, there's no record of this conversation, but the records are incomplete, and we can't draw a conclusion about whether it's true or not. Look, Bush and Cheney went in there and were categorical in their statements, and they were basically daring a bipartisan commission to call them liars. I found some more evidence on this and, examined the record pretty carefully and asked some questions that the 9/11 Commission didn't ask. And I think it's almost impossible to conclude that Bush gave that order before Cheney did. And one of the interesting things that turned up is that Cheney changed his story in a very meaningful way at just the moment when the previous story could have been disproved. His initial account was that he had this conversation with Bush in the tunnel that leads into the presidential bunker the minute he walked in there. And there was no reason to think anyone could dispute that. There's no record of what was said in the call. But it turned out there was a very good record of exactly when that call took place and exactly when the shoot-down order was first issued. And it turned out that conversation could not have been the one in which Bush said that. So now, by itself, doesn't prove everything. People get confused about which call on a very busy, hectic, adrenaline-filled day. Something happened. But the problem is the next record of a phone call between them takes place somewhere between 8 and 15 minutes after the order is issued. The 9/11 Commission asked certain questions. It asked, is there any record that Bush talked to Cheney about this? And it couldn't find one. It did not ask, is there any record that Bush talked to anyone about this? Did he display awareness aboard Air Force One with his chief of staff and the commander of the Situation Room who travels with him and Ari Fleischer, who was sitting there knowing it was a historic day, taking notes on every word Bush said? Did he display any awareness of this huge, momentous decision? And the answer is no, he didn't.
You talk about how Cheney amassed power, and you talk about him in several places, or you quote someone, I think, calling him the consummate staffer. And you explain that he knew from his previous experience in the executive branch that it wasn't about who controlled policy, but it was more about scheduling and appointments and personnel and who you could put here and there. And you describe how Cheney put people into the bureaucracy in very specific places so that later on he could reach in if he wanted to. you know, to get something done, you say he appointed a deputy director of OMB and a deputy national security advisor and the deputy assistant secretary of the Interior for Fish and Wildlife. So tell us, there's a California story in there too that's kind of interesting. Tell us about Sue Ellen Wooldridge and what her experience was with the vice president.
One of my favorite stories. Sue Ellen Wooldridge was the 19th ranking official at the Interior Department. She was a deputy chief of staff, and she comes to work one day, and you know, voicemail's blinking, and she listens to the message, and this is Dick Cheney. I understand you're the person in charge of this Klamath situation, meaning the Klamath River Basin, and please call me at, I guess I don't know my own number. I'm over at the White House. Click. And she said, "Who would fall for that? Who could possibly imagine that the vice president is leaving this message on the phone of the 19th ranking Interior Department official?" And she used words to me to describe her reaction that you can't put in a family newspaper. She said, "I thought somebody was messing with me," except she didn't say messing. And she hit, you know, asterisk D, delete. And thought no more about it. And she, 6 hours later, she comes back from another meeting, and there's another message, and it's Cheney's deputy domestic policy advisor, a guy named Ron Christie. And the message is there any special reason why you're not returning the call, the Vice President of the United States? And it turns out that, I mean, he has this habit of reaching way down through layers of bureaucracy. He understands those sort of like the junctures of power and decision making. He understands that so many huge decisions never get to the cabinet level, let alone the Oval Office. That's why he doesn't appoint. I mean, Bush is the decider when he wants to be, and he overrules Cheney plenty of times. But there's plenty more times when Cheney acts and the president either doesn't really know or care or says fine. And so a guy named Paul Hoffman, who was head of Cheney's congressional office in Wyoming, becomes this deputy assistant secretary for Fish and Wildlife. And that turns out to be a very big deal because Cheney is deeply interested in making sure that water can flow a certain way or that endangered species rulings go a certain way, because they're very much related to A, his philosophy of government and regulation, and B, his driving desire to produce more energy with more fossil fuel. And that has impact on air and water and national parks, and a guy like Paul Hoffman can be very helpful there.
Let's move on to what is one of the really harrowing stories, or I found it harrowing, in the book, and that's the story of Cheney's meeting with Dick Armey. Tell us what happened in that meeting, and then I have a few questions about it and what we can learn from it.
This really is one of those sort of hinge of history kind of moments, because Dick Armey, House Majority Leader, 100% conservative rating Texan pro-military, was a big skeptic about war with Iraq. And in the summer of 2002, he said, "You know, I don't see any reason why we should have this war." And he said it in public. The decision of the White House is that they're going to ask for a congressional war resolution in early October of 2002. You trust, stop for a second and think about what it would mean to have the Republican majority leader vote no. It would have given cover to every Democrat who had a doubt. There were a lot of people. Armey said to me, "Look, everybody was afraid to look like the guy who doesn't want to go out and kill people." It's a year after 9/11. Being soft on terror is a bad idea politically. He says now that he believes that if he had continued to say no, he would have defeated the resolution. Bush couldn't change his mind. Bush invited him to Camp David. He arranged a special briefing with George Tenet. There were five or six things like that. None of them worked. So now he's Cheney's project. So Cheney is, Mr. Fix-It on stuff like this, and he had an old relationship with Armey. Cheney had this little hideaway office in the Capitol, room H208, and he invited Armey one day to come in there. And he said, I'm going to give you a special briefing. This is the really sensitive stuff. We haven't talked about it before. We don't want to alarm the public. It's worse than we say. And he tells him two things. He tells him Saddam Hussein has direct personal family ties to al-Qaeda. And he tells him that Iraq is well on its way to developing miniature nuclear weapons. So the scenario is suitcase nuke, good pal of al-Qaeda. Who knows what will happen, but it's bad. Army told me that he just could not, he could not maintain his opposition in the face of that. Now, I know from a lot of heavy reporting on this that this is not like the stuff that Cheney was saying in public where, you know, did he exaggerate? Did he rely on unreliable evidence? Did he cherry pick? This is just flat out, there's just no evidence for it. It's made up. And Cheney knew that Army's vote was absolutely pivotal. And Army has held his silence all these years, but he's a very angry man about this. And he said that he believes Cheney lied to him, and he knowingly. And he also used words that you can't put in the family newspaper.
Is this why you had to write a book? Because you couldn't get these words into your paper?
Yeah, it was accumulated frustration and desire to unleash the profanity of Washington.
But that story brings me to a question, which I think is at the heart of the book. And that is, you know, there are a lot of people out there, probably a lot of people in this audience, a lot of people who believe that this entire war, you know, was built on a lie, and it was built on a lie from people who had some other objective. They wanted to line their pockets. They represented, you know, they wanted to help Halliburton. They wanted to help the oil companies. They had all kinds of ulterior motives. And this story seems to lend credence to that. You have Dick Cheney walking into the office and telling an out-and-out lie. My question is, you know, who is Dick Cheney? Is he an evil, lying manipulator of the facts? Is he a man of no principles? You take a very nuanced view of Cheney and why he told these lies and what it means. And tell us a little bit about his character and why you think that he would walk in there and tell Dick Armey these what appear to be utter untruths.
I just want to make clear, there's analysis and there's context and there's assessment in this book, but it's not a political book. It is a book of stories. It's a narrative, and it's sort of getting behind the scenes of things that we didn't know about before. So it's not super heavy on judgment. I do have a view on this. I think that Cheney ends justify means for him. The ends he's pretty open about. I mean, he lays it on the table. You watch him on Meet the Press or listen to him on the, you know, the radio talk shows that he goes on to. He says he believes that this country is in mortal danger, that it's worse than people realize, that he always uses the word unpleasant. Unpleasant measures have to be taken to protect the country, and if people don't get that, they're basically naive. All that's on the table, and all that is, in fact, what drives him. He believed that he was acting in the best interests of the nation. I work really hard to establish whether there was any venal motive, whether there was any money issue, whether he was trying to line the pockets of friends or set up something for Halliburton. Actually, it turns out that Cheney went way beyond the requirements of government ethics laws and gave away somewhere between $4 and $5 million. Early on, and didn't tell anyone because he's that kind of guy, very secretive. Even when it would help him, he doesn't tell you. But he gave away $4 or $5 million he did not have to give away in order to make sure there was no conceivable hypothetical reason why he would be interested personally in bolstering Halliburton's fortunes. I think he does this stuff because he's a true believer. And people who don't want to give him his principles, I think, are you know, sort of prefer a cartoon to, you know, what really drives people and policy. And, you know, I would just remind everyone that zeal, zealous pressing of principle has usually a lot more impact on history, for good or ill, than all the equivocators and opportunists and hypocrites. If you really believe something and you're willing to push it all the way to the end, that's Dick Cheney.
mean, you describe it in the book. You're right. There's not a lot of analysis of why he's doing it. There's not a lot of judgment in it. Mostly, it's you let the stories tell themselves. But you do describe it several times. Once, I think you say he could not wait for categorical truth. Once you say you describe, or someone describes, a sense of mission so acute he sought power without limit. I mean, at the end of the day, would you say that this is someone you admire because he's a man of principle, or is this someone you find repugnant because he bends the truth and manipulates it? Is it something in between?
I'm honestly much more interested in turning up things we didn't know than trying to decide, you know, whether I like him or don't like him. I'll say that I used to know him better. When I covered the Pentagon, he was very accessible. You know,
when he was Secretary of Defense.
When he was Secretary of Defense, early 90s, he, you know, those days, the plane he would fly to the Middle East had to refuel in Ireland. So we'd sort of sit down at Shannon, and there's a really good bar there with really good Irish stout. And he would come out and he would join the reporters and shoot the breeze and, you know, sort of make fun of his military assistant and all that. And he's, on a personal level, very likable. He is... his work ethic is unbelievable. He's devoted himself to what he believes is public service. I think that you can do all that and still have enormously destructive impact. And even by his own standards of what he was trying to accomplish, you know, energy security and national security, and even the acknowledgement of executive authority, he has overreached and created backlash and has not advanced his own causes. And I think there's very close to a consensus. I mean, there still has to be a political debate about this because it has partisan implications, but there's pretty close to a consensus on the part of the sort of, you know, the opinion makers and military officer corps and intelligence analysts that the Iraq war has been just a strategic disaster. That's comparable to almost, you know, nothing before, and it certainly isn't the outcome that Cheney would have liked. I think he worked very hard at some financial cost to himself and cost to his own health for things he believed in, but he wrought tremendous damage.
I mean, one of the things that you say about him that helps explain that is that he has a worldview that is basically dark, pessimistic. You know, he's always looking at worst-case scenarios. He's only happy when he's looking at worst-case scenarios, or he only thinks he's being honest. If you read the book, you'll see that Cheney has a lot of nicknames. Some of them we've heard. One of them is Darth Vader. And my favorite story about the Darth Vader nickname is that, and this is, I don't think this is in your book, but apparently when Cheney goes and he gives speeches, he likes to use the line that he went to his wife and said to her, you know, honey, do you get angry when you hear that people are calling me Darth Vader? And she says, no, not at all. It humanizes you. The name of the book is based on one of his nicknames. So, you know, then there's another one that I love, which is they call him the management. Why do they? Explain about Angler and management.
Just management. Like, you know, we better check with management before we bring that to the president. I really don't want to get the wrong idea. Bush pushed him back and said no a number of times. Because Bush fundamentally has a politician's instincts and Cheney is an anti-politician. Just as one example I talk about in the book, Cheney became convinced on the basis of very ambiguous evidence that there were undeclared stockpiles of smallpox, a disease which has been eradicated in nature and is supposed to exist only in laboratories, and one in Russia, one here at the CDC in Atlanta. He became convinced that there were hostile states that had secret stockpiles of this, then it would be a devastating terrorist weapon, which it would. And he advocated that the president order a nationwide inoculation against an eradicated disease. And the public health authorities sat down in a room along with intelligence people and policymakers, Cheney, Bush, and they told the president, if you do that, you'll kill about 300 people just from the side effects of the vaccine. And Cheney said, go right ahead. I mean, that's too bad, but how will you feel if 20,000 die because you didn't do this? And it's if, it's hypothetical. There's, it's what one of his advisors said to me, and what Cheney thinks of it, the low probability, high consequence event. And how do you weigh that kind of balance? Cheney weighs it in favor of assuming the worst. He believes he's a very dark view of human nature. It was not idle when he said publicly right after 9/11 that famously said that, you know, we're going to have to work the dark side. And I think actually he knew what image he was invoking. I mean, Star Wars had, you know, was so much a part of the pop culture. And Darth Vader, I mean, you know, he dressed his dog up as Darth Vader for Halloween. You know, he knew what he was saying. He said, this is reality. All you naive people who, you know, want to talk about the niceties of how you treat terrorists and, you know, whether you need to sign this writ or that writ before you listen to phone calls, you know, you are missing something really big and really important. And if your view were to prevail one day, you would terribly regret it. That's his view.
So for the beginning of Bush's term, you know, Cheney wields all this power. And you tell a lot of stories, and the stories are pretty dark, and some of them are scary. But there's one story of real, I mean, to me, a tremendously dramatic story of courage in this book. It's sort of the dramatic climax of the book, and that's the story of Jim Comey and Jack Goldsmith and this titanic battle between the Justice Department and Cheney's people. And it's the first time in the book, and I think the first time in the administration, where Cheney gets beaten back. Tell us what happened there.
Yeah, this is something I did not expect to find. I didn't find out until past the deadline for turning in my manuscript. I'll start with what everybody knows. Everybody knows about the famous bedside visit to Ashcroft in the hospital, where Andy Card and Alberto Gonzalez, the chief of staff, the White House counsel, come and ask this semi-conscious man to sign something because his deputy, the acting attorney general, Jim Comey, won't sign it, which is to certify the lawfulness of the domestic surveillance. And we know from Comey's testimony in Congress in summer of 2007 that Ashcroft sort of sits up in bed and says, you know, no, I'm backing my deputy, and anyway, I'm not the attorney general. He is, because I've relinquished my powers. There's a lot more that happened in that room. There's a lot more that happened before and after that's never been told. And Andy Card, Condi Rice, Jim Comey, Dan Bartlett, and others talked to me on the record about this for the first time, and a lot of other people wouldn't talk to me on the record, but that filled in some important blanks. And the stunning thing to me is, well, first of all, in the hospital room, this has not come out before. Ashcroft didn't just say, I'm back in Comey now. He said, based on what I now know, I never should have signed this in the first place for the last year and a half. And more importantly, there was a major, intense legal dispute between Justice and the Vice President's office and the Vice President personally that lasted 3 months. And this covers two chapters in the book. It's way more than I can tell here, but I was able to reconstruct, you know, using, you know, emails and calendars and documents as well as these people's on-the-record interviews, you know, in the kind of pivotal last 10 days, you know, almost hour by hour, what happened here. And the stunning thing to me is that for 3 months, Cheney tried to put down this rebellion, and Bush did not know about it. And Bush found out the day before the program was going to expire. It had to be certified every 45 days by the Justice Department. He found out the day before that Justice wouldn't do it. And this suddenly explains, now we know, it's a whole new thing, why did Card and Gonzalez turn up at the hospital room? Because Bush said, Comey, what? You know, you march right over there and get Ashcroft to do it. It seemed to Bush to be almost like a coup. You know, Attorney General goes to the hospital and then his deputy raises this last-minute objection. Then Bush, the next day, signs a renewal of this program over Justice Department objections, and at that time he does not know that he's about to face a mass exodus from his government. He doesn't know that not only Comey, but the FBI Director Bob Mueller, the general counsel of the CIA, general counsel of the FBI, the top five layers of management at Justice are all going to leave. Now, remember,
they're all saying they're about to resign because the president has signed this thing without Justice Department authorization, right, because they believe it to be illegal.
Now, these are presidential appointees. They're conservatives. They actually do believe that the president gets to make the final call on, because they believe in the unitary executive in the sense that the executive power, according to Article 2, is vested in the president. And so any power of the Justice Department is delegated by him. So they believe that in principle he has the right to do this, but they believe that it also is that they can find no lawful basis for it, and he's entitled to do what he wants, but they're not going to work for him anymore. And they're actually, you know, I mean, they've written their resignation letters. I have Comey's resignation letter. I put it in the book. And it's quite dramatic. It's very in your face. And Bush doesn't find out until Friday morning, the day after he signed this thing, that these people are about to leave. And he finds out almost by accident. There's sort of a complicated chain of events that I reconstruct, but Condi Rice, who knows about the program but does not know quite what's going on at Justice, hears that something bad is happening at Justice. She doesn't know quite what. She says to the president, 7:30 Friday morning, you better talk to Jim Comey. Something's going on over there. At 8:30, Comey and Mueller arrive at the White House for what they believe is their last day in government, and they give the president his regular terrorism briefing, and they're walking out the door, and their intention is to resign that day. And Bush, having heard this from Rice, says to Comey, hey, Jim, can I talk to you a minute? And he brings him into his private dining room, which is where he has his lunch once a week with Dick Cheney, but this time Cheney's not invited. Bush says to Comey, you know, what's going on? And because of access to contemporary notes and an email that Comey sent on his BlackBerry immediately after leaving that meeting, I was able to reconstruct pretty closely what happened there. And each of those guys gets a big surprise. Comey is stunned when Bush says, I just wish you weren't raising this at the last minute, day before the deadline. Comey just can't believe it. I mean, he's been in this huge fight since December. And then Bush gets surprised. Comey says, you know, Mr. President, I think you should know that Director Mueller is going to resign today. And the word I use in the book is that Bush is gobsmacked. And of course, that day, he completely does an about-face. He reverses course. He understands. Here's what Dan Bartlett and another senior political advisor told me. Try to imagine, you know, put your mind back to Watergate, Saturday Night Massacre. Saturday Night Massacre was the Attorney General, the Deputy Attorney General, and the Special Prosecutor, three people. Now you're going to have about two dozen people, including the FBI Director. And you know, that whole cast of characters and a lot more. You know, you really wouldn't call that a massacre, you'd call that suicide. And Bartlett made it pretty clear he thought that Bush would have been a one-term president.
So you said during the course of telling this story that you talked to Andy Cardin, you talked to Condoleezza Rice on the record, you talked to Dan Bartlett, you've told us that you talked to Dan Quayle. I mean, tell us a little bit about the reporting for this book. I mean, I think you can tell from Bart's stories that he's done an extraordinary amount of reporting. He's looked at old, you know, emails. He's gotten files, secret files that no one's seen. I can tell you, in the beginning of the book, he talks about when Cheney was leading the search for a vice president, and he ultimately decided that he was the only person who could fill the job. But in the process of running this search, he made the candidates fill out these voluminous, incredibly long, incredibly detailed reports. Bart obviously got access to some of those. He says that they tell you the details of Governor Frank Keating's sphincter and testicles. And you didn't go into any detail about what exactly you learn about it, but obviously you saw the reporting is extraordinary. How do you do it? Well, I don't understand, speaking as a reporter, why would Condoleezza Rice, currently still working in the White House, why would she get on the phone with you to talk about the man who's still the vice president? What's in it for her? Why would she talk on the record? Why would she talk off the record?
Sometimes people say things that are really, really important, and they don't know how important they are. Condi Rice did not. She thought she was being pretty cautious. I saw her in her seventh floor office at State. It's a gorgeous, ornate room. And, you know, all she told me is that she'd heard something going on at Justice, and she said to the president, you know what, Jim Comey's a reasonable guy. You really ought to see what's on his mind. she didn't know how huge that moment was. I mean, that George Bush, she rescued George Bush without knowing it, because Bush was right on the cliff's edge and he didn't know it. And this is how he found out. Other people are sort of have kind of wanted to tell their story and weren't sure they were ready. Some people, you know the expression that it used to be true until, I don't know whether you could say it's true right now in the current circumstances, but if you want to borrow money, you have to have some money. Let's just take that as an expression. It works well as a reporting model. You kind of come up with a question, maybe even a theory about what the answer is, although my theories are often wrong. You figure out a list of everybody who could possibly know that, and you get some background on it, and then you go around the circle again, and every time you go around the circle, you get just a little bit more. And at a certain point, you can start to talk people into talking who didn't want to talk before. Andy Card hung up on me 3 times over the course of a year and a half and wouldn't talk about anything. And finally, I got to him with, here's what I know about this. Before you hang up, you ought to know I know this, this, and this. And he didn't say, okay, I'll talk to you. He just started arguing with me. And before I knew it, I'd catch him on the phone for half an hour, and I had a really good interview that
he didn't mean to give it all.
That said a lot. Jim Comey had refused resolutely to talk to anybody for a year and a half, and I don't know why he talked to me exactly, except that what he said to me is I'd been around that circle many times, and he was hearing back from his friends and former colleagues what I knew and what I was asking about. Finally said, it just seems like you're actually going to write the story about as fully as it's going to get written, and I better participate.
How much of your best information came from off-the-record sources as opposed to on-the-record?
Well, a huge amount of it came initially from off-the-record sources, but one of the things that I worked on very hard, because I know that people are deeply skeptical of this sort of anonymity, is to figure out some way to motivate people to go on the record. And honestly, I try to shame them. I have a kind of well-developed pitch in which I tell someone, okay, well, you have called yourself a public servant. You think that what you've done is public service. And I claim to you that public service does not end when you box up your stuff and leave the office. That public service includes making sure that we know what happened and what worked and what didn't and what went wrong and why and what are the lessons learned. Because, we're about to have a new guy in that office on January 21st. And they're going to face, exactly the same kinds of problems. And wouldn't it be crazy if we didn't even know what happened last time? And you've always been a stand-up person. You say you fought for what you believed in. Well, why in God's name would you just, sort of hide behind anonymity now?
Did Cheney talk to you at any point?
Nope. I used to talk to him, like I say, back when he was defense secretary. He didn't. He let me accompany him to Texas on Air Force Two on this one trip, and he spoke to soldiers at Fort Hood and did a fundraiser and so on, but he did not come back to the press section. And actually what he did was, I was sitting next to Bill Salmon from the Washington Examiner, which is very conservative, kind of an ideological paper, and one of his aides came to Bill Salmon and said, can I see you for a minute? And they tried to hide it from me. I could tell, he got an exclusive interview with Cheney. He was sitting right next to me. He got called forward to the cabinet. So I never did talk to him for the book. I did talk to a lot of people who worked for him. But the really tough thing here that I'm trying to crack is Cheney, Scooter Libby, and David Eddington can or won't talk to me. I mean, Libby can't because he's under, this whole legal, probably still hopes for a pardon. Yet I'm trying to reconstruct things that they're involved in, so I have to use other methods. And I know people are also very skeptical. How do I know what I claim to know in this book? I have 70 pages of really fine print and notes that make it as transparent as I can.
Did you find out at any point during the course of your reporting that Cheney knew what you were up to, that he was asking people what you were asking about, that he was trying to do any damage control?
Yeah, he's very big on intel gathering. And he and his people were following the progress of the book, and they were trying to tell people, what not to talk about or what to talk about, and some of them told me that, and some of them didn't, and some of them refused to talk to me, and lots of people did. I mean, and as I say, the best stuff I got was from people who didn't know how big a deal it was, because they had this much of the picture, and I needed to know that much. I didn't have it, but they didn't know the context, and so they didn't know how significant it was.
Two more quick questions, and I'm going to open it up to the audience. One of them is, have you heard anything from Cheney's office since the book came out?
No. The book began as a series in the Washington Post 15 months ago, though two-thirds, three-quarters of it is new stuff I either didn't know then or hadn't happened yet or I didn't have room for. But after the series, which painted a roughly similar picture of a guy who sort of, angler is a good metaphor for the way he worked, I heard pretty reliably, and this has to be an anonymous source, that Cheney kind of liked it. He didn't think I was trying to do him any favors, but if you're getting close to lame duck status and there's 20,000 words in the paper that make you look like a really tough guy, that has some value.
Before I stop, I just want to ask you about the one line in the book. You say, sort of on balance, you say, the vice president shifted America's course more than any terrorist could have done. What did you mean by that?
It's such a commonplace. If you Google 9/11 and, quote, everything changed, unquote, I don't know, you get 100,000 references. And what exactly is it that changed on 9/11? There was a terrible human tragedy. Thousands of lives were lost, billions of dollars of economic damage. But if you sort of set that in the context of, dry statistics, if you look at CDC mortality statistics, there was a 50% increase over the expected death rate on one day, and then it went back to normal. I mean, there have been a lot worse human tragedies in our history. There have been a lot more costly disasters. That doesn't fully measure what happened because, it actually announces a much more dangerous and imminent and ambitious kind of terrorist threat in the territory of the United States. But did everything change just because of the attack? What really changed was that the U.S. government transformed its relationship to its citizens, to other countries, that it claimed on behalf of the executive enormous new powers that were unchecked and unaccountable. Cheney established the idea that the president could override explicit felony prohibitions in surveillance law, or that the president did not need to obey explicit undertakings both of domestic and international law on the Geneva Conventions, which the United States basically wrote, and so on down the line. Cheney changed things in this country and in its relation to the world much more than Osama bin Laden did.
Thank you. So let's open this up for questions. We have about 10 or 15 minutes for it. I want to reiterate what Louise said at the beginning. Please make your questions. Keep them short. Don't give speeches. Okay. And you have a mic and you have a mic? Okay. Let's start with that guy behind you there.
Hi. Is there any, since Cheney obviously cares about policy and not politics, is there any evidence that he and his assistants are making any efforts to infiltrate themselves into a follow-up administration?
That would be tricky. Although he apparently is a distant cousin of Obama, probably not going to find a lot of takers there. And he and McCain it's fair to say McCain is the last guy Cheney would have wanted to win the nomination. Liz Cheney went on television and said it would be bad for the country if McCain were president. He's clashed with Cheney on on torture, on Iraq, on executive authority, on lots of things, and they don't get along. You know, on the other hand, Steve Schmidt, McCain's campaign manager, was Cheney's communications director at one point. But you know, that is not an example of Cheney placing someone somewhere. That's an example of one of the sort of permanent operatives of the Republican Party, you know, finding a new gig. By the way, Schmidt sort of laundered himself on the way to McCain by working for Schwarzenegger.
Two quick questions. First of all, can you comment on Cheney's use of the RNC email address versus the White House email address and what happened to those emails that were supposedly lost? And then second, how would you compare Cheney to the Jack Nicholson character, Colonel Jessup, in A Few Good Men?
That's a great question. It has not been established, as far as I know, that Cheney or his office were involved in the RNC email dodge. That was much more the political operation in the White House, Rove and company. But here's the thing about Cheney. He's too smart to use email. He is not going to write stuff down. I mean, this idea of Sarah Palin using a Yahoo account and then writing about how that will help get around disclosure requirements and putting that down on paper. I mean, that's you know, that might be an attempt to be Cheney-like, but it's completely amateur. Cheney's office didn't use email. Scooter Libby was asked in grand jury, do you use email? And he said, because he used to be a very heavy user of email as a lawyer, and he said, not in my current job. They don't write things down. When they do write things down, they handwrite them. And they actually made up a new classification stamp that actually has no legal status, but it has a rationality to it. You know, there's three categories of classified information. There's confidential, secret, top secret, and after top secret, there's, you know, sensitive compartmented information, SCI, stuff that has code names. Cheney's office made up all these official-looking stamps that said, treat as secret/SCI. Now, it had no legal status, and it was already being kept in safes anyway. The impact of that is on historians, because his papers will all get shipped off to the National Archives, and some future archivist is going to see a bunch of papers that say treat as secret/SCI. Are they going to put that into the release pile? They're going to put it into some special pile for hand sorting that will take decades, and there'll be a big chunk of the national memory that's missing.
Are you familiar enough with A Few Good Men to...
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I am, actually. And I think that You Can't Handle the Truth is an important thing to understand about Cheney. He does not have much respect for public opinion. He casts it in a way that a lot of people could agree with, which is that a politician shouldn't sort of bend with the wind, and you can't let polls decide what you do every day. And he takes it to an extreme, which, I mean, and his belief is that we, the public, are, you know, sort of emotional, illogical, feckless, you know, changeable, don't really quite get the main point, or misinformed about the facts. And it would be lunacy to let public opinion guide what you do. And so he actually wears his unpopularity, and, you know, he long ago surpassed Dan Quayle as the least admired vice president in the history of modern polling. He wears that as kind of a badge of honor. I mean, as proof that he's doing the right thing and not worrying about his own personal popularity. So it actually becomes sort of a transaction about Dick Cheney. And he thinks that if you speak too frankly with the public's going to make the wrong choices. So, you know, You Can't Handle the Truth is sort of right.
You have an anecdote in the book where some, I think it's a reporter, comes up to him and says something about how, you know, is he aware of the fact that 2/3 of the country opposed the war or something? And he just looks the reporter right in the eye and says, "So."
Yeah, I mean, some of you may have seen that on ABC News. Martha Raddatz asked him that question at some gorgeous, gigantic, gilded palace in the Gulf, where she accompanied him on this trip, and she said, 2/3 of Americans think the war's not worth fighting." And he said, "So." And he later said that he was saying, "Well, what's your question?" But that was one of those. I watched that video about 40 times, and I know Cheney. He is not an anti-Democrat. He has a very narrow understanding of what representation means. It's kind of, you know, Edmund Burke from, it's the 18th century, English philosophy that the founders, left behind when they drove across the Atlantic. It's the idea that a government is a trustee for us. The government is our trustee. You choose a surgeon, you do your research, you hire a doctor, you don't tell him where to cut. In 4 years you get to choose another one. That's his view.
If you survive.
In California, the Brown Act prohibits the conduct of state affairs, the people's affairs, behind closed doors in secret. When Dick Cheney got to the White House, he conducted secret meetings with oil company executives. To this day, we don't know what went on. Did you make any effort to find out those proceedings?
Yeah, there's a chapter on the Energy Task Force that also it blends into his understanding of the Constitution and of executive authority and of presidential secrecy. And so I take the chapter name from Federalist Number 70, which he likes to quote Hamilton. So that it's a little play on words. So the chapter is called Energy in the Executive. Which is what Hamilton said is so important about about a unitary presidency that can act with swiftness and decision and consistency and dispatch. I've not advanced the ball very much on what happened in those meetings. I have ruled out some of the things, though. I believe it's pretty clear that Cheney was not trying to do favors to the oil companies or his own personal wealth or the wealth of his friends or campaign contributors. The thing is, his view of the national interest coincided very closely with their view of their corporate interest. He believed that the country desperately needed more energy, that it's all well and good to talk about, solar and ethanol and hydrogen one day or geothermal, but if you look at the hard numbers, and he thinks of himself as a hard-headed guy, it's all about fossil fuels for the foreseeable future. And if you want more production, you have to loosen restrictions on emissions of pollutants. You have to stop being so worried about some endangered sardine somewhere. Actually, there was one case where it was minnows, and a whole chapter on salmon and then this whole Klamath River controversy. He just thought that is what is standing in our way. Now, that was music to the ears of the oil companies, the energy utilities, and so on, but he wasn't doing that to please them. He's doing that because he honestly believed that's what the country needed. I think there's pretty good evidence for that.
I'm interested in the event that didn't happen, which was that moment when Condoleezza Rice alerted the president, and the president found out he found out what Cheney didn't tell him. And two parts of that question. One is, did you come across other instances where Cheney withheld from the president for such an extended period of time a controversy that was going on within his own administration? And what did Cheney think would happen had, let's say, Bush had not been alerted by Condoleezza Rice and they had gone off the cliff? How did he expect to survive that? Because Bush would have then known the next day.
Cheney believes that, what you get paid for if you're the commander-in-chief is to make the tough decisions, the unpleasant decisions. You've heard him say all this in public. And let the chips fall where they may. And that's what leadership is for. It's to carry the country with you. If you believe, Mr. President, that this is the most important intelligence gathering operation we have, and you know you do believe it, and if even the Justice Department concedes that you are the chief law enforcement officer, unpopular or not, you can't be blackmailed by your subordinates into swerving from the right course. I think he believed that Bush could ride it out. I think that was wrong. But I don't know. I mean, I can't tell you I'm on the inside of his head. I know what happened, and I know what some of their exchanges were, and there's others that I don't, and I can't know. I try to be very careful in the book to distinguish what I have evidence for and what I don't. I thought you were going with this is, you know, why wasn't somebody fired? I mean, what chief executive would find out he'd been blindsided that badly? Can't fire the vice president, but Andy Card and Al Gonzalez knew and didn't tell Bush. And by the time it was time to tell Bush, it was going to be really inconvenient. If Cheney and Addington, David Addington, his lawyer, have been saying all along, we're going to handle this, and you know, we can put these guys down. And there's some really dramatic moments in the book about ways they tried to do that. And then finally, you realize, good Lord, it's one day before the deadline, and they haven't caved over there at Justice. You know, would you like to be Andy Card and tell the president, well, Mr. President, you know, we've been trying for 3 months to convince the Justice Department to withdraw its belief that this program that you think so important is illegal. And it turns out that, nobody wants to tell that to their boss, nobody. And, you know, I don't think Andy Card or Al Gonzalez are particularly strong figures, and I think that comes through in Card's interview in the book. And so Bush, I don't think anybody lied to Bush. They don't think they had to. They didn't have to say, well, this just came up. They have to say, Mr. President, you know, this program that John Ashcroft has been signing all these months, Ashcroft's in the hospital and Jim Comey won't sign. We don't know what to do. And the president forms a pretty strong view that this just happened. Nobody tells him it just happened. But I to this day, don't understand why he didn't probe further and why heads didn't roll. I do think, and I think I show in the book, that it was a turning point in the Bush-Cheney relationship, and that Bush was a lot more cautious with Cheney after that. And it's not just me saying that. Dan Bartlett says so.
All right, there are a lot more hands out here. I apologize. We only have time for two more questions. So how about this woman back here? This woman.
On NPR, you made some comments that I wished you would elaborate on. The one was that he was never vetted, that he never filled out the form. And the other was that the doctor who supposedly, who cleared him, never saw, of heart problems, never saw him. Could you comment on why we didn't ever know that, or did we just, what happened?
Well, I'll tell the story, and I'll start off with the second answer. I get a lot of angry phone calls and emails, you know, now you tell us. There's 5 minutes left in the Bush administration. You know, why would, you know, what were you afraid of? Why wouldn't you tell us sooner? And the answer is that this kind of reporting cannot be done in real time. It just can't. There are things I can do to find stuff out by reconstructing that take a long time and that require the passage of time before people have the guts to start to give me the clues that let me unravel the story. The story is, Cheney devised the most intrusive, unbelievably probing vetting process for potential running mates that's ever been devised. Now, that's not to say, you know, there's anything automatically wrong with that. The VP selection vetting decisions are usually made with an enormous amount of scrutiny, and every year, every election, they add more to the questionnaire in response to scandals of the last time. And that was true in the McCain campaign, too, by the way. The guy who ran the vetting is a lawyer named A.B. Kolbehaus, who advised Lamar Alexander in preparing his vetting file for Cheney and Bush back in 2000. He knows how it's done. It was the candidate who short-circuited that in McCain's case. But there are other candidates who, you know, there were other potential running mates for McCain who went through the whole thing with, you know, boxes of documents. I mean, look, Cheney's questionnaire asked about infidelities, about drug abuse, about the kind of things that a person wouldn't tell their best friend. It actually asked, and just as baldly as this, what is there in your past that would subject you to blackmail? And I guess the only prudent course on that would be to take the questionnaire and throw it away and say, never mind. You're not going to want to answer yes to that question. So Cheney knew a lot about these people. And look, you don't want a black available vice president or potential commander-in-chief. So, I mean, there's a rational cause for it. But Cheney did not fill out his own questionnaire. And when the question of his health came up, as it would, since he'd had already 4 heart attacks, I think it's 4 at that time, the campaign asked Denton Cooley, who's an eminent Houston heart surgeon, to give sort of a second opinion and vouch for Cheney's health. And Cooley did that, but what he says in an on-the-record interview in the book is that he actually never met Cheney and had not been allowed to review Cheney's medical records. He talked to Cheney's own doctor, who assured him that his health was fine.
Okay, last question. This woman here in the...
When Bush ran for the second time, there were rumors that Cheney might not be on the ticket, and I was just wondering if there was any truth to that. And a couple of years ago, there were a lot of rumors that he might resign or be asked to leave. Was there any truth to that possibility?
Well, as a Pentagon philosopher once said, you don't know what you don't know. I found no evidence for either of those things. I personally doubt it, but I can't prove a negative. I just didn't come up with any evidence that Bush seriously considered taking him off the ticket or that Cheney was going to resign. There were these scenarios that said, well, they were going to set up Rice for her own presidential run by having Cheney resign, Rice becomes vice president and all that. I don't think any of that is true, but I can't say for sure.
Okay, I'm very sorry that we have to stop while there are still questions out there, but we ran out of time. Thank you very much.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.